A piece of myself. It has almost been 2 years since my parents died and we cleaned out the house, but I still have a few boxes of random mementos sitting here in my office. Every month I have promised to do the final sorting, but have made limited progress. In this month's feeble effort, I came across two envelopes. One was labeled Ralph's First Haircut, 1925, and the second one, Fanny Day Farwell's Hair, November 23, 1936. My father was two at the time. His envelope contains a yellowed piece of tissue paper holding a small lock of blonde hair tied with an itty blue bow. My mother was nine, and she must have had a major makeover, since her envelope contains a huge wad of long, thick auburn hair. My cleanup project abruptly ended as I stopped to ponder, what should I do with these souvenirs? Do I need to poll my siblings to see if any of them wants the envelopes? Or perhaps I could divvy it up and send each their fair share of hair. And why do people save hair, anyway? I was in a wool store once when a woman came in with a large amount of dog hair that she had collected over the years and then spun into fiber. She said that she was interested in knitting a vest for herself made out of the dog hair. The shop owner sized the situation up and told the customer that she'd need to collect more hair for the pattern she had picked out. She wistfully responded, "I can't. The dog is dead." When I type dog hair spun into Google, there are thousands of entries for dog hair, including spinning services and knitting patterns. I found a picture of a lovely older woman, despite her yellowed teeth, who was modeling a cozy-looking hat made from a Belgian sheepdog and a two-tone scarf made from a Labrador and Golden Retriever. It's borderline to truly creepy, with slightly Nazi overtones, to extrapolate dog hair to human hair, but I learned from the internet that human hair has been spun for millennia to make braided watch bands, bracelets, bookmarks, and even jewelry. Another website describes the practice of using spun human hair from different family members to create embellishments for a family wall hanging. Still slightly creepy, but this seems to get at the reason why my grandparents saved their children's hair. Pictures, movies, art projects, report cards are fine, but a collection of hair is probably the only way to create an enduring physical memento of a loved one. The pleasure must have been more conceptual than real, since I'm quite certain that my grandparents did not return to the envelopes to touch or stroke the hair to prompt misty-eyed memories. In fact, I'm probably the only one who has opened these envelopes, which have been moved to attic until their final resting place in my office. About the same time I was dealing with my parents' hair, I stumbled across my own very permanent physical memento, even better than hair or bronze baby booties. My karyotype, created 25 years ago when I worked in a cytogenetics laboratory as part of my pathology training. A karyotype is a collection of a person's chromosomes, 23 pairs for a total of 26, each recognized by the pattern of stripes or bands along the chromosome's length, and the location of the waist, called the centromere, which is the anchor where the chromosomes are yanked apart when the cell divides. I remember standing on a laboratory stool with an eyedropper full of cells and aiming it at a tilted glass slide. Carefully, I would squeeze out a single drop so that it would splatter on the slide, splitting open the cells and scattering the chromosomes. I would then stain the slide to produce a characteristic banding pattern. My job in the cytogenetics lab consisted of staring at other people's chromosomes to make sure that they were all there, or that the chromosomes had not swapped pieces with each other. I took advantage of this job to create my own vanity karyotype, which I have treasured for the past 30 years. It has been posted on a refrigerator or in a frame on the mantel, but after our last move it got buried in a drawer, so I was delighted to find it after a 5-year absence. Even now, after so many years, my pattern recognition skills are intact. I instantly recognize my tall and willowy chromosome 1. Chromosome 6 was always a particular favorite, since the waist and banding pattern remind me of a hula dancer with a bikini top and a grass skirt. Of course, I have two proud and strong X chromosomes, and I've always thought it was a little ironic that the single Y chromosome is just a tiny smidge of genetic material. In a professional karyotype, the individual chromosomes are snipped out and arranged in order by size from chromosome 1 to the sex chromosomes, like a police lineup. But I have left my chromosomes where they lay, and the resulting picture has much more personality. As a group, the chromosomes look more like an aerial view of dancers on a dance floor, with chromosome 9 cutting in on chromosome 2, and both chromosomes 1 bent at the waist like they're really rocking out. splattered off to the side, chromosome 17 looks like a timid wallflower. My individuality is not visible from this level. That would require the identification of the individual genes on the chromosomes, i.e. genotyping. In fact, my karyotype would not look any different than Hitler's or Mother Teresa. But regardless, I see a very personal statement. It is still pure me and a distillation of my ancestors. In addition to the locks of hair, two family portraits have emerged from the attic, my great-great-great-grandparents Henry and Nancy Farwell. They are both dour characters dressed in black, only Nancy adorned with a lace bonnet and collar. Maybe my genes have gotten a bit dinged up through five generations of millions of divisions, but 1/32 of my karyotype can be traced back to each of these people. More so than a lock of hair or my gallstone that I was so enamored of last month, I am quite confident that future generations will not consider this a treasured memento of my physical being. This karyotype is my very core being. In the debate between nature and nurture, I am staring at ground zero for nature. I wonder what genes have been plumped up by my nurturing environment. Certainly the one for wordplay, since I grew up surrounded by constant games, ditties, and doggerel. That gene has been carefully stroked for decades to create a genetic family recipe spewing out some sort of secret wordplay sauce that lets me know that sweaty is the perfect rhyme for spaghetti, and that excitus and hepatitis are made for each other. But as I look at my karyotype, I wonder what other family jewels are hidden in there, just waiting for a little nurture to blossom and change my life. Perhaps Henry Farwell was extremely limber. If this bequeathed gene had been given the proper attention, I might have found success as a circus contortionist. Perhaps, as her portrait suggests, Nancy Farwell was pious and obstinate, and I should be grateful that future generations just buried this legacy. There is no medical situation where needing a karyotype is a good thing. Usually the indication is some sort of leukemia, birth defect, or infertility. But I can see another money-making opportunity for cash-strapped cytogenetics laboratories. How about vanity karyotypes as an addition to a family tree? Forget the hair or the bronze baby shoes. I would love a tree that included a picture and then maybe a miniature karyotype. Even though the chromosomes themselves would look similar across generations, they would still be dancing around on their own stage.